Welcome to Season 9, Episode 11 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we talk about player characters in prisons. We also discuss the possibility of the 1950s, 1960s B-movies as game settings. Again, welcome to Season 9, Episode 11 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this episode is Chris. Welcome, Chris.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, and you know, hopefully you had a pretty good weekend. Because I had Memorial Day yesterday, I'm recording a day late, but it shouldn't go out too late, much later.
Well yeah, it was Memorial Day for you, I believe.
Yeah, you know, in the U.S. we have Memorial Day, and it's, I don't know. It's one of those weird holidays now for me. I figure it's like most holidays for me. I always figure that people have no idea what the holiday is really about anymore.
So. Yeah, but you were in the Navy, so you have kind of your own special connection to that.
True, but and it's hard to explain to people that yes, Memorial Day is kind of related to service, but it's really for those who died.
Yeah,
and. Actually, Memorial Day wasn't always called Memorial Day. There are certain places that used to call it Decoration Day.
Okay.
And that has to go back to where they would go out and decorate the graves.
Yeah, I can believe that.
And, like, the only reason I know that is because there's an old blues song that's called Decoration Day. And it's like, what the fuck are they talking about? And it's kind of a Remembrance Day kind of thing.
Yeah, so. No problem. We have something similar up here. It's Remembrance Day. It's on November 11th. Of course, it's the 11th hour, the 11th day, you know.
Well,
the end of World War I.
Yeah, and here in the United States, that's Veterans Day.
Okay.
So it's kind of weird. It's kind of weird. It's like, so in the U.S., we kind of have Memorial Day for those that died, and then Veterans Day for those that are still living.
I gotcha.
You know, that's the kind of way it works, but a lot of people confuse them, and I'm like, it's okay. I understand. It's like at least that's an understandable confusion rather than being like, I don't know what Memorial Day is. It's for me to go to the lake and go jet ski. Yeah, that's not what it's about, pal.
Probably a little bit of poor taste, put it mildly.
I think it's one of those things where people started celebrating Memorial Day or any day like that, and it changed from a Remembrance Day to something a little more crazier. And then, of course... In the United States, all the sales happen around Memorial Day. You know, appliances, cars, you name it. Oh, it's Memorial Day. Come to the Memorial Day. You know, of course, in the United States, anything's good for a sale. It's President's Day. We have a President's Day sale. I don't care. I seriously doubt that George Washington or Abraham Lincoln really needed a washer or dryer.
I was putting it mildly. They probably think it was possessed or something.
So... At any rate, we are here, and we do have one, I guess, tiny bit of sad news. You pointed this out, so we figured we'd bring it up.
Sure. Writer and designer Anna Bly passed away a couple of days ago. He was particularly known for his work in Fantasy Flight, and particularly with the new Star Wars game. Here, let's pull the rest of the notes as it comes up. You know.
Yeah, I mean, there's different things. I guess he worked for Games Workshop for a long time.
For 14 years, yeah. And he was a key member of Forge World Studio for over a decade and was involved in the Horus Heresy games. So, you know, he's involved in Dark Heresy, Rogue Trader, and Death Watch role-playing books, as well as designing several Arkham novels. So,
yeah,
he's in our hearts because it always sucks when a fellow gamer drops his dice for the last time.
Yeah, because he obviously used his dice. He wasn't a member of the Amber Society.
Yeah, fair enough. No, I don't see no Amber dice still around there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Somebody wondering, like, what the hell are you talking about, Amber? Yeah, there was a game system, people. Never played that one. Have you ever looked at that?
I've looked at it. I've never actually played it. But, you know, again, I'm game curious. I'll play any game once.
I don't know. Sometimes I'm hesitant to even do that.
I don't blame you.
I will read a rule book for any game at least once. How about that?
Yeah, well, let's just say if you put Fatal in front of me, I'll probably run away screaming. But, you know, I'm morbidly curious about most things.
Yeah.
You know, mind you, the other one might be that Cyborg Commando, that Gygax game that he wrote in the 80s that looks like either a cross between a mathematics equation and boredom.
That was a weird game. I actually owned that one at one point.
Okay.
And the only reason I remember, the only thing I'm, again, I never played it, and I don't own it anymore, but I remember the weird die roll mechanic, which was something along the lines as you take your 2d10, roll them, and multiply them.
Sounds obviously complex.
Well, the weird thing was is that you were supposed to do that. At least that's what I remember, and I could be wrong. You were supposed to do that, and it was like you would have skills that were percentiles, and you're supposed to roll under numbers. And I'm like, okay. Wait a minute. It's not a steady progression. It's a weird... There's like certain percentage values you can never get. It's like, it does you no good to have like, say, 95% in something because the lowest number you can get is 90. You know, yeah. To be in the 90 percentiles. It's like 10 times 9 is 90.
Yeah, and then basically got a 10%
you know, margin. 9 times 9 is 81. It's like, I don't get the scale. So, that was just a weird game. I'm sure there was some sort of reason for it, but I don't remember.
No, that's understandable.
So.
Okay.
But we mentioned last episode we started diverging into possible prison scenarios, and so we figured we'd put a pin in that and talk about it this episode because, hey, you know what? Why not? And
exactly.
I think the reason this concept is always near and dear to my heart for me has always been Adventure 8, Prison Planet for Traveler.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I explained in the last episode that it was kind of strange as an adventure because the players start off in prison.
Mm-hmm.
But the adventure itself isn't a traditional adventure, per se, because you plan things out and it's like it goes by weeks. There's like a whole system to on how on running the adventures because you have events and encounters and... There's a whole note of, you know, how the prison system works for the game and, you know, what happens. And there's this event table.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of weird because it's been a while since I've read it, but if memory serves me, you used to have to, like, plan out, like, your things on a week basis. You know, you wouldn't be like, well, on day one, I'm doing this. And in this hour, you know, the time constraint, you know, I think the assumption is you're going to be there several years before you can escape. You're not going to escape, like, in 2 days.
No. First, you got to figure out the lay of the land and figure out how the heck it's even feasible and whether there's even an option.
Right.
Because they're designed specifically to keep you inside. If anything, what's more likely to be involved more in the prison culture, you know? There's going to be a lot of boring periods, try not to piss off certain factions and just see where it leads, or better yet, piss them off and see what happens as far as the adventure is concerned. Like, a good friend of mine wrote a bunch of stuff that may come out eventually. I game with him. His name is Joe Iman. He did a fantastic job. So a lot of what I'm about to say, I will give him full credit for. But he brought up some of the following questions when your guys get thrown in the pokey. Who are the people in charge? Who holds the keys to where? And what do they want that the PCs might be able to provide? How does the prison work? How do the people in charge make sure the prisoners behave? What plans do they have in place for when they don't? Is the prison place peaceful when the PCs arrive, or a powder keg? What ways can the new bloods turn the situation to their advantage? How are the prisoners divided? By race, country, magical abilities, etc.? What groups are getting screwed over more often than others? And also, what's the overall routine of the prison? Like, when do you eat? When do you allowed to work out? When are you locked in your cell, basically doing nothing? If you got an idea what the pacing is, it'll help you figure out what you want to do or not do with it. And just by answering some of these questions when you're stuck under lock and key, and how will they maintain you? Like, a prison is going to be a lot different in, say, Star Trek than it will be in your typical fantasy environment, like, or pretty much every single Oblivion game where you start off in prison or going to be hanged.
Yeah, you know, but it's also interesting, and I think I also talked about this, was, you know, I don't know, I like the idea of a prison game for a start in adventure. I know there was like at least one or two fantasy games like that where the player characters start in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know there's some adventures like that, and it's like you always wonder. It's like, well, how, you know? It's like you got to role play their escape, and it's like, well, that's gonna be fun.
Yeah, trust me, that's Well, it'd be fun for like a one and done, but ultimately, unless the game is specifically a prison game,
right?
You know, where you're basically trying to control the cigarettes in the family or something, you might get kind of bored of it after a while.
Yeah.
That being said, when you're dealing with factions, I guess you could treat it like a mini city, where this side's controlled by this faction, this side's controlled by this faction, and you basically have to navigate your way through it or build your own faction in the process. Like, also, there's going to be lots of impediments when you deal with stuff, everything ranging from automatic defenses, which would be symbols, cameras, or, you know, automatic weapons, or laser automatic barriers. Sometimes a good old-fashioned piece of metal will fall from the, you know, fall on the wall to block you off. Or if it's magically based, it might be a force field. What sort of guard beasts do you have, like dogs or geese or even more bizarre creatures? Often a lot of these prisons have these really cool high-tech collars that can range anything from chalk collars to, like in Running Man, where they blow your head off if you go too far.
Well, there's also a couple other movies that had exploding collars. Like, I forget what the hell they were. There was like a movie, and then they did a it was kind of a low budget movie, and then there was a remake of the same movie, where, and I forget who the hell was in them.
Are you thinking Battle Royale or
no? The idea was that the problem, everyone was within a certain area, and two people's collars were linked together, but you didn't know who your collar was linked to, and if you left the range of the other collar, it would explode.
Okay, so that's a good way to know what your buddy is and find out what's happening.
Well, the whole point was that it was random and you didn't know who that person was.
Yeah, that's nasty.
You know, and I want to say it was a movie with Rutger Howard in it, because that sounds about right. I want to say Rutger Howard and Mimi Rogers comes to mind.
Well,
and I know, I swear they did like either a remake of it or something that used the basic same plot line.
I'm certainly guessing there for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a B movie.
Well, that's the whole point, you know, for stuff like that. No, Wedlock, 1991.
There you go. See, I'm not.
Oh wait, it's called Deadlock, actually.
Deadlock, yeah, Wedlock, Deadlock, yeah, same thing.
Yeah, close enough for prime time, I guess. Yeah, and so basically, other stuff could be is the prison set up in a hostile environment? Like in Avatar The Last Airbender, they put it in the middle of a boiling lake. It was called Boiling Rock Prison because it was right in the middle of a volcano. But it was, you know, basically if you went swimming in there, you basically burn.
Well, hell.
Or,
Just take real life. I mean, there's a reason that we let Alcatraz be Alcatraz for the longest time.
Yeah, the rock. Basically stuck in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, still got to swim, and most people can't.
Well, not only that, but the currents in that river were pretty strong, and the water is really cold.
Yeah.
So there was lots of things against it, if you will.
Oh, absolutely. And what about Star Trek VI, where they basically put you on a hostile moon and say, "You want to be our prisoner because you go outside, you will die."
Ruapinte, yeah.
Yes. also go with the standard stuff, walls and guards. Like one of my favorite types of prisons is actually one that usually you're breaking out of. It's called Castle Wolfenstein. Where it's a repurposed Nazi castle where your hero, B.G. Blazkowicz, basically has to work his way out by essentially punching Nazis.
Yeah, you know, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
You know, and it's I'm just saying, you know, it's like, and there's obviously a lot of inspiration you can use for these movies. I mean, you've just mentioned, you know, you have the Star Trek movies, you have, you know, obviously a whole bunch of other movies, and then you have the classical movie, you know, prison movies, like Escape from Alcatraz and The Shawshank Redemption and, you know, any number of other sources, I mean.
Yeah. Well, again, like Aliens 3 was definitely a prison movie for all intents and purposes.
Oh, yeah.
Or you go back to
That's actually another interesting point. Yeah, that's true. I forgot about that. I didn't think that was a great movie, but yeah, all those guys were prisoners.
Yep. And again, even a bad movie can be easily cribbed on for a great game when you think about it. Like, or you go back to even more fantasy times, like the classic novel Man in the Iron Mask is a prison movie. The guy breaks out of prison.
That's a classic one, yeah.
You know?
You know, it's funny. I was actually thinking about that one when I mentioned this last time. Or, you know, the Count of Monte Cristo, in a way.
Absolutely. And, you know, you go for the more classic stuff. Like, if you want to go for a more sillier type of campaign, there's always Hogan's Heroes. And,
you know, actually, that would be, you know, if you don't want to say, don't want to be silly about it, but, you know, as something that could be interesting in itself, where it is a prison environment and it is kind of a prison scenario, but you actually kind of want to be there for some odd reason.
Yeah, absolutely.
you know.
And that way it'll expand the game when it comes down to stuff there. Like, and of course there's the whole genre of movies from the 60s to like the 80s, the women in prison movies, which I'm just putting more as a placeholder than anything else. But
more as a placeholder.
Yeah. Or Con Air, which is, you know, the Nicolas Cage classic movie where, you know, basically it's a bunch of cons on a plane. And there's a lot of potential for concepts and ideas from there, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even from history, I mean, there's some interesting stuff you can do, you know? You talk about, you know, Prison Break. I mean, you look at, you know, prison ships that they used to just leave in the harbor, you know, prison barges, if you will. Escape from that sucker. There you go. There's one for you.
Oh, I got one for you. Australia! Well, think about it. You get sent off to the middle of another continent, whether you do it in like a, you know, historical perspective, or you send them into, you know, a fantasy environment where you basically have one of those islands that there be dragons and you're basically stuck on it if you don't want to deal with them.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, that actually has possibilities.
Or when Marvel did the Civil War, which kind of sucked, they sent all the superheroes that didn't register that got arrested into the negative zone. So you're basically in a dimension. Or Superman's...
Phantom Zone.
Phantom Zone, exactly. And, you know, they have different variety and there's different ways of getting there, but ultimately your PCs are going to want to try to figure a way to either get the hell out or have a reason to be there. And stuff like that. Or even the classic TV show The Prisoner. It's an island, but it's still a prison. You know, it's a nice, friendly place.
Oh, yes. Can I get a map?
Exactly. Well, again, these are some of the reasons, assuming it's voluntary to be there. You're there as a distraction. You're there to make contact with a prisoner who knows something or has something. Setting up a prison break. And, of course, my personal favorite, revolutionaries. Because I always think when it comes to prisons and issues is how the Shining Path in Peru, even though they're all a bunch of prisoners, have managed to take over a good chunks of the prison. They're basically cells of communists, at least until like recently, where they literally had to send the army into the prisons in order to deal with them. Which can add a really interesting faction, especially when gods really do exist in your fantasy game.
Yeah, or that could be interesting. But I guess, you know, I guess we should talk about, as a game master, obviously, let's say we do want to run some sort of prison scenario. And I guess the question is that, do you want to start from, you know, you mentioned some possibilities, like, okay, the players want to be there because, you know, they're trying to do a revolution or they're trying to make contact with someone, or do you want it to be a prison break? Because, I mean, you almost have to say, if it's not voluntary, you're trying to create the prison break scenario.
Yes, pretty much given.
You know, which in itself, the players have to be okay with. This, the prison scenario is one of those weird ones where you need a lot of player buy-in.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if your players don't want in, you're not going to be able to pull it off.
Right.
You know, but players might just rock off right there.
You know, and I think this is definitely one of those concepts that I think works well for like the initial scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, in some of the ones, like, I don't know, maybe make contact with a prisoner. That might be like a small one-shot couple of adventures, something smaller. And when you do that, obviously, you know, the prison will be smaller. Some of the stuff that you'd want to deal with in a more blown-out campaign, you wouldn't bother with.
Yeah. And on top of that, it's a good option if you end up having a TPK and you don't want a TPK. Hey, you didn't die, but you're now in prison. What are you going to do about it?
Actually, just being a prisoner. I mean, think about it. I mean, you get attacked, you get hurt, and you don't die, but, you know, now you're in, I don't know, a hobgoblin prison camp.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
You know, I mean, that has to be tough, you know? I mean, or even just an orc prison camp. I mean, I think of, or you find yourself a prisoner of a few orcs, and there's a few thousand orcs outside, kind of like Lord of the Rings.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, that could be bad.
Well, I always think of that one prison in the Civil War, that one Confederate camp that was basically one of the most hellish places you could ever go to. I can't remember where it was, though. I think it was...
Was it a north or south prison?
It was a southern prison.
Oh. Yeah,
it was one of those legendary... I think it was the... Yeah, it was Camp Ford near Tyler, Texas, I think is the one that just had an insane body count between the hangings and the thing there that, you know. Like, the reason I remember that is that one of my favorite shows until recently was Hell on Wheels, and one of the characters who was the villain was a nice guy until he went to that prison. And as a result, ever since then, he's been like an absolute monster.
Yeah, I think I saw the first one or two seasons of that.
Yeah. You know, again, it was a fun series. Like, the Swede was absolutely terrifying. He was a monster. But he was a monster for all the right reasons, if that makes any sense. You know, he was literally broken by the prison and forced to conform, but still a monster, if that makes any sense. Great character. You know, honestly, and great characters are how you build decent prisons, because nobody's going to remember how you broke out of X, Y, or Z. But you're all going to remember some prison boss here. Or, did you ever see Daredevil? The Netflix series.
Yes.
Okay.
Just the first season.
Okay, the second season, Castle shows up. He basically gets guilty and gets thrown into maximum security prison. And it's the same prison the Kingpin's in.
Hmm.
The Kingpin basically offers him a way to get out, you know, basically uses him as a patsy, throws a ton of men at him. They all die because, well, it's Castle. And so basically they make some sort of unholy alliance to get him out of there so he can continue his quest. But there's going to be a comeuppance if he ever when he gets his own series, that's for sure. And guys like that who are, you know, you don't go to prison because you're a nice guy. That's all I'm going to say. Or if you do, how the hell do you get stuck there in the first place? Like, what happened? Or did you change over time? Or are you like Hannibal Lecter in a, you know, security cell?
Yeah, I guess I guess in some ways that's actually an interesting point. I mean, if you look at Silence of the Lambs, it's kind of a prison break.
Exactly.
You know, it's a subplot adventure.
Exactly.
You know, I always tell people, I said, you know, the funny thing about Silence of the Lambs is, while you may not agree with Hannibal Lecter, at the end of the movie, when he says, I'm going to see an old friend for lunch, I don't know a single person that didn't say, that guy deserves that.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, it's one of those weird things where it's like, you know, he's an evil guy. But I understand that. I understand why. I understand that kind of revenge. You know, it's kind of weird how even that you're like, I can relate to him on that level. And you're like, wait a minute, he's a psychopath.
Hey, just because the guy's a monster doesn't mean he's wrong. The thing is, whether you want to go down that path yourself, ultimately, and 9 times out of 10, PCs say, sure!
Well, you know, it's like the classic tag. It's like, what is it, murder hobos?
Exactly.
You know, which is another topic we can talk about. It's like, why do all games end up being that way?
Yeah, that's true. Well, we can put a pin on it when, you know, for next time, that's for sure. Because that might be a fun topic in its own right. How do you murder hoboize your game?
But I guess I guess still the big thing is, like, again, like I said, when you're running these type of scenarios, you have to have players buy in, because, you know, they know they want to escape prison, but they got to be willing to be in prison.
Yeah.
For these type of games or scenarios to work, and you're going to have. In some cases, you're going to have one guy that's just going to say, my character would never be in prison. Okay, thanks. You're just, I mean, it may very well be, depending on the, you know, you know, when you do these things, you really have to look at what concepts do your players have for players. You know, if it's some, like you said, if it's some sort of like action adventure hour type game, if you will, where, you know, the people that come to mind are like the A-Team. It's like, okay, we're going to sneak into the prison to get this guy out because, you know, he's in prison wrongly in a foreign country.
Yeah.
Or something along those lines. Or even like a spy movie or something along those lines. Matter of fact, actually, spy movies probably more prevalent in this. Like, what is he doing? Oh, he's in this weird prison, or he's a prisoner of these people or hostage. Yeah, I mean, that's a weird thing. In some ways, prisons, you can almost swap this to be almost kind of more of a hostage situation in a way, because, hey, they are prisoners. And that would actually be a weird twist for player characters, to be not necessarily the prisoners, but the hostages.
Exactly. Somehow you managed to do it there, and you're basically were there at the wrong place at the wrong time, and you basically got stuck there, and now you got to deal with overzealous, you know, freedom. Maybe they got a bioweapon or something, or maybe some weird spell or something.
I don't know why. I don't know why. Every time I think of hostages and a weird scenario, I always think of Die Hard, the original Die Hard movie.
Well, absolutely. You know, where you see poor Bruce Willis run through getting his feet chewed out by glass.
Yeah, exactly. And that one scene where he's like, we have people with glass everywhere. Glass? You're talking about glass.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but that's just one of those movies that is such fun to watch.
Absolutely.
And
I got
course,
a guilty.
And of course, yeah. Alan Rickman's in it, so you can't go wrong.
Hey, dude, Rickman has saved more than one movie in his lifetime, that's for sure.
Well, he was definitely the best part of the Kevin Costner Robin Hood movie.
Oh, God, yes. That goes with those things.
You know, it's like you watch that movie just for him. Screw everything else going on. You watch it for Alan Rickman in that movie.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, I got another movie for you. Escape Plan.
Which one?
Escape Plan. It was a movie that was done back in 2013. It stars Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Wow, I don't think I've seen that one.
This one I actually really liked, but it might not be everybody's cup of tea. Sly's playing a structural security authority who tests prisons. He gets in and he gets out.
You know what? See, now that would be an interesting scenario for players.
Yep.
That'd be an interesting way to get players into an adventure. Be like, you know, it's like, hey, you know what? We are, you know, something stupid like, especially like a science fiction game, that'd be a great way, you know, like, because a lot of science fiction games are player characters are almost like random troubleshooters anyway.
Yes.
So they're kind of troubleshooters for hire usually. Mm-hmm. Especially like Traveler. But that'd be a great way to get them into Traveler. It's like, well, maybe they have some sort of reputation. And so to me, it'd be like, hey, you know, we already have this prison, but we're fearful that, like, I don't know, some guy will escape. And we want you to test the security of the prison, but no one can know that you're a member of the thing.
Yeah.
Actually, you know what else comes to mind? Is another scenario that would be very interesting.
Okay.
Where the player characters pull a Brew Breaker scenario.
Yes.
They're trying to find out what's wrong with the prison. And so they go undercover as prisoners initially.
Yeah.
That could be interesting.
Yeah, and then basically halfway through the adventure, hey, you're not you.
Exactly.
That's actually pretty awesome. Good way to play it. But you need buy-in, of course.
Oh, again, yeah, all these things would need buy-ins. And some of these things, honestly, I think they'd be great, like mini one-shot campaigns.
Yeah.
I wouldn't expect the characters to continue. And actually, you know, I'm going to say, in defense of the one-shot campaign, as long as you have player character buy-in, I think they can be some of the more interesting campaigns, because then player characters are like, I'm not worried about my character surviving or being really strange. I know that that's bizarre, but just like, you can almost, I think in the one-shot scenarios, you can almost accept, even as a game master, like, you want to be really fucking weird? Okay, go for it. I don't give a shit, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you might break some of the normal rules that you have in place.
Makes sense to
that's
me.
That's just me. I don't know.
Well, again, you could almost take... Wow. There's just so many different options you could try or situation here. Like, what if you decide to do... You're a bunch of prisoners, and then you find out you're getting sent to the gladiation arenas, or whether it's like a fantasy from Rome or the Running Man.
That's actually a very interesting scenario in itself. I mean, because that's true, you know? Because that'd be one of those things where you're sent... I could see... That'd be a fascinating one where you start off kind of in prison. You kind of have the prison environment. And then you're chosen to do gladiatorial games.
Exactly.
And then if you survive that, you're actually, you know, maybe get your freedom or not.
Yeah, and that could have a whole bunch of different contexts depending on what you're doing or not.
Well, and I'm just thinking. It's like, you know, let's say you're really good in, let's just take, like, if you did, like, a fantasy realm.
Yeah.
You know, and you end up being gladiators for a while. And then, you know, maybe... You win your freedom, but then you have whoever your patron is to say, hey, listen, you offered your freedom in exchange for doing adventures on the outside for him.
Yeah.
You know, that could be a very interesting slope or a very interesting arc of a story.
Yep.
You know, but that's something that requires a lot of planning.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And if you, you know, there's a good chance that you might end up going Spartacus, you know, to some degree, especially if you become a high level hero. Shit. And that's always fun in its own right.
You know what? That's actually a movie I forgot to mention. Spartacus, because that is kind of a prison break movie in a way.
Yeah. Well, it's a slave rebellion, and I guess that's the ultimate sign of a prison, is when you're basically a slave for life.
Yeah. That's actually very interesting. That's actually, you know, honestly, that's a strange movie that I like.
Absolutely.
Of course, you can't go wrong, Kirk Douglas. I mean, come on.
No. The Sword and Sandals is almost a big enough genre that we almost need to put a pin in its own right, because there's just so many great movies that were done between the 40s to, like, late 60s. In its own right, they could probably strip heavily from.
All right, we'll do that. Because, you know, I hate to say it, but I love movies, and I especially love the old movies. So if we talk a lot about the old movies, I apologize if you're not interested, folks.
No worries. That's part of the reason we're film buffs, I guess, and we love looking at all sorts of weird, crazy movies and see where it leads.
Well, you know, I think a lot of it has to do, at least for me, is that, especially growing up, you know, a lot of the TV stations didn't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
So they showed the craziest stuff just to have stuff to show. I mean, people don't realize that before stations could be like these affiliates for things like the CW and other things. They were just independent stations. They had to fill their time. I mean, this is why Star Trek had a resurgence, folks.
Because it was cheap.
Well, that was it. It was cheap. And it's like, I mean, if it wasn't for that, I mean, I remember coming home from school every day and I was able to watch Star Trek.
Indeed.
You know, I mean, so, I mean, I'm not as serious a Trekkie as some people are. That's okay. But I like Star Trek, generally speaking. And, I mean, I always tell people that growing up, my hero if I had to pick someone to be my, you know, the hero that I would most want to emulate, it was always Spock.
Well, duh. Logical, intelligent, incredibly powerfully built.
And no offense, all the hot women really wanted him.
Yeah.
I'm serious. I mean, if you watch the original Star Trek, it's like, you know, Kirk had some people, but it's like, yeah, but those aren't women you want. All the really hot women that you'd want were always hot for Spock, it seemed.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking that with the Romulan captain, it was fun.
Yeah, I'm just saying, you know, that was one of those weird things. I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, that makes sense. I'm down with that.
And again, how many times did Kirk and Spock get thrown in some prison in some way, shape, or form in the original series?
Oh, all the time.
To the point where there's almost blasé about the situation, because they're so used to it.
Yeah,
hell, I mean, the same degree.
Oh, we're in prison now. Let's see.
Need to get out. It's a Nazi prison somehow, even though we're on a space planet.
Yeah.
Well, we'll make a laser.
Exactly.
Yeah. And of course, if you're going to go for other prison movies, you want to go for something that's equally historical, you got to go for The Great Escape.
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, hell, I mean, any of the war movies that had prison scenes in them. Yeah. But yeah, The Great Escape is the classic for that.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, or if you want to go for something a little bit mournful, you could go for A Bridge on the River Kwai.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, mind you, that might break your heart if you don't do it right. Mind you, I always like the Winning Schuster parody, Kwamea River.
Okay. All right, since we're still on the topic of movies, why don't we kick over to emulating B-movies?
Awesome.
Especially the 50s and 60s sci-fi, because you know what? I have a soft spot for these movies, plus I really kind of have a soft spot for the 1950s, 60s... sci-fi books, even.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and I think a lot of it has to do just with, in some cases, some of them actually involve some real science, which was really bizarre. You're like, they use like some, well, this is a scientific stuff we know. Let's extrapolate that to something ridiculous. And sometimes we watch science fiction movies today, and they don't really do that as well. And I don't know what it is. And I don't know if it's because, you know, I don't know. I can't explain it.
Well, I think it was just a lot of stuff here. A lot of the science was new. We ended up building all sorts of really new stuff. In many ways, the 50s and 60s, I'm going to call it atomic horror because that's what GURPS calls it, era, is almost an extension of the pulp game, but there's three crucial elements that change everything. One, radiation exists for real. It's not just a concept. It really does exist in this era. In fact, it was a super weapon that ultimately changed the universe as we know it. It is both wonderful and horrific. So basically just add radiation to create half your stuff.
Oh, well, not only that, but it was like the wonder energy source as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I take the the Mystery Science Theater 3000 movie did a spoof of it, but this Island Earth where it's like, well, if you just take this to atomic power, okay, yeah, that's great. You know, exactly. But it was weird. It was like the word. It's like you just throw atomic. It's kind of like, honestly.
Genetic engineer today.
Well, no, I was thinking of riffs with plasma. It's just like add plasma. Everything you just add atomic to, and okay, it's better. It's not just a plane. It's an atomic plane. You know, it's not just a monster. It's an atomic monster.
Hey, explains Godzilla, if nothing
exactly.
else.
Exactly.
And yes, it does make things better. This is also the era of technobabble. Like, yes, there was technobabble before, but this is when, like you said, they started really trying to blur the line between science fiction and science fantasy for a lot of their stuff. Like, they started trying to, because we had all those stupid, if you ever watch the 50s to 60s, those informative videos, you know which ones I'm talking about, where they teach you all about these things and they have the PSAs. And that's actually where they're kind of cribbing for a lot of them when it comes to stuff like that. And of course, it all accumulates with Star Trek, who I'd say is the ultimate pinnacle of technobabble. And while science may be dangerous, more often than not, it also saves the day. Whether even if sometimes this thing that it creates in the first place is truly terrifying, like, you know, which we'll get to later. trust me, I got monsters. I love monsters, especially 50s monsters. They're so bloody creative. And there's often a conflicting lead, usually between, because this was the Cold War.
Oh, yeah.
And as a result, there was a lot of the enemies were essentially reskinned commies or reskinned radiation, kind of to deal with some of the horror effects that were happening during this period. And often you had a conflicting leads of an army man versus a square-jawed scientist, because this was when scientists were manly men.
Or they were portrayed that way.
Oh, absolutely. They were always probably bigger and tougher than they probably would be in real life, but that's not a bad thing.
You know
they're
what,
science.
Though? Yeah, I, it's funny because, but yet, I know people that would be like that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you could argue who's a scientist, you know.
Yeah.
Although, you know, this is what I always tell people. It's like, you never know who has a really good degree in something.
Absolutely.
I mean, I always point people. It's like some of the people that you wouldn't think would be very intelligent are very intelligent. Take Dolph Lundgren.
Oh, Dolph Lundgren was one of the most hideously... he's the Nietzschean Uberman, man. Between the fact that he's built like a brick privy, the man has masters in chemistry and has taught classes in universities.
Yeah.
And on top of his acting career.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. The reason he actually had a slot, I think, for a PhD, and the only reason he didn't take it, because his girlfriend at the time, you know who his girlfriend was at the time?
I do not know.
Grace Jones.
Oh, wow. That's a weird relationship.
Yeah.
It was.
Convinced him that maybe he should try acting.
Oh, wow.
Or something along those lines.
That's a weird...
Yeah, exactly.
Story arc, man.
His story is very weird, but yeah, you know, he's not a dumb guy.
No.
You know, and it's just, it's fascinating when you go like, really? The man who beat up Rocky? You know?
Yeah.
So, no, yeah. I mean, and there are those people,
mm-hmm.
You know, but you're right. I mean, you take, even if you don't even take the B science fiction movies, I mean, let's face it, you take like Indiana Jones, he's I hate to call him an archaeologist because my buddy's in the archaeology world.
Trust me, he's doing real archaeology. He'd be digging in a 10x10 area.
Exactly. Well, that, and it, you know, it's like, I'm trying, you know, he's a treasure hunter who thinks he's an archaeologist.
Well, he's kind of like the original archaeologists, the antiquarians, you know, that one strong man in Egypt who used to blow up coffins in order to get at mummies. You know, he's not nearly as bad. Like, you got to read about this guy. I can't remember his name for the life of me. But he was basically, you know, obviously a little bit more before this area, but there was literally this Italian strongman who personifies the worst you could have in archaeology.
I think of even people that weren't even archaeologists.
Giovanni Battista Belzoni. That's his name. You guys want to know. And you got to read about this guy if you guys are interested. Anybody wants to read about him, you got to read about him. But that's very much off topic, so we'll go back a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's just one of those things. So, but you have some interesting things here about common archetypes in these settings.
Yeah. Well, you got academics, you got the scientists, which you talked about. Sometimes you're copper fed, often a bit of a rogue cannon because you're trying to figure out something. Yeah.
And, you know, honestly, in the 50s, 60s still, you're probably an FBI / G-man.
Absolutely.
You know, there's none of that, oh, I'm from the Department of Family and Security. No, no such thing. I mean, even this, honestly, even the CIA during these movie times wasn't the popular choice. It'd be like the FBI guy.
Exactly, because, you know, he's the guy that took out Uncle Bone.
I think a lot had to do, of course, with, what's his name? Hoover.
Oh, yeah, J. Edgar Hoover was probably used for propaganda purposes, because that was the era.
Yeah.
And, of course, you got explorers who were going out in the middle of nowhere, because this is literally the 11th hour of any chance you had. You know, technically all the borders were filled in, but not most of the audience didn't know that yet. So you could find some mysterious island out in the middle of nowhere or something, or go to the new places like outer space or under the sea.
Especially under the sea, that was popular. But you're right, outer space too. But I'm just saying, you know, under the sea, outer space.
Yep. And going so basically, or Hollow Earth, if you want to use this, you know, old discredited theories. Basically, going through the north, you end up in the other side of the earth. Okay. Also, you can play an industrialist, which is another classic example, because you always have one. He's usually played more as the foil for the heroes, but he can be played either way, because, you know, Batman. But obviously, a little previous to the time, but you get the idea there. But it seemed like for most, if you're going to play a female in the Atomic Horror game and you want to play at least somewhat truth to form, and you want to be an adventurer, usually you end up as a journalist. You know, basically you're looking for the big scoop. You know, whether it's Lois Lane, whether it's the person who's looking up some radioactive fruit in the beginning of the end, you're there, you're a hero, but ultimately you don't do much, so you'd almost have to break stereotype to make it more useful.
Yeah that, yeah. Or especially in these movies, you're like the accidental secretary that happens to be there.
Exactly.
You know, which is kind of bad, but you know, you could, you for more modern sensibilities, there are changes you could easily make. Because let's face it, we do know from even from history that A, there were female scientists, probably not as well regarded, unfortunately, as their male counterparts.
Yeah, the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe actually works their ass off and has something called Forgotten Superheroes of Science, where they go over people that have been kind of panned over.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are female, and some of them are even from this era here, and they did some truly amazing stuff.
Oh yeah, I mean it is kind of interesting when you find out about that stuff. You're just like, holy crap! I mean, there are some people. I mean, I don't know. I'm just always in awe at some of the, considering the restraints that were put upon some of these women.
Yeah,
it's amazing some of the shit that they did.
Yeah, and if worse comes to worse, you could always play one from the Iron Curtain, like some of the female snipers from the Soviet era are just terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, you've heard some of the stories of those suckers. And of course, one of the common archetypes from this era is the kid, teenager, or tag-along. Basically, that annoying kid that annoys the crap out of you. That often plays a pivotal role in the story, usually more often than not. You know? Also, you could play a loner, you know, one of those drifters that drifts into town at the wrong time, thus setting off the horror/sci-fi adventure. Of course, military men of all sorts have always played a prominent role in these things. You know, to what degree remains to be seen. Like, Forbidden Planet has an entire army of them, which is proto-Star Trek.
Forbidden Planet? You know, that's actually a very classic adventure when you movie, yes, when you look at that.
Oh,
and,
absolutely.
And it's actually funny looking at, what's his name? I can't think of his name, because it was a serious role for him.
Oh, Leslie Nielsen?
Yeah, there we go.
And it's he did a fantastic job.
I know, but it's just so funny. You're just like, but you know, you're right. That actually is very, if you look at that Forbidden Planet, that is almost the prototypical Star Trek adventure.
Yep. They script heavily from it, and that's a good thing. Or you could end up playing something like The Day the Earth Stood Still, where you have the military people as the antagonist, as the alien shows down, but still is in a dangerous situation here, where you try to herd a alien in using CB radios. Which is still kind of awesome.
The Day of the course Earth Stood Still. You know, actually, I was just thinking, that was the other, you know, that was another weird one where there was a kid, and that's kind of how the mother got involved in the adventure.
Absolutely.
Which is kind of a weird setup, but I mean, that's kind of the way that worked.
Well, absolutely, and of course, you're going to have, you know, if you want to play the other side of the coin, you can play mobsters, because just because you're a crook doesn't mean you want the world to end.
And actually, I mean, my favorite example I mean, granted, this isn't really a B science fiction. Well,
yeah, well, fair enough.
'50s or '60s, but kind of more of the '40s line. Is I was thinking of the movie The Rocketeer, where, you know, it's like the gangsters were like, "Hey, I may be a crook, but I'm still an American."
Exactly.
That's kind of the mythology. Oh, and I love the next one.
Yeah, go for it.
The Private Dick.
Oh, absolutely. Like, dude, everything from the 30s up to the 60s, if you need a detective to basically put the pieces together, it makes it a little bit of noir into your atomic horror, and it makes it better.
Oh, yeah. I mean, who doesn't want Mike Hammer? You're right.
Absolutely. Besides, you got somebody who bungles in and bungles off. In fact, right now, I don't know, have you ever seen Archer?
Yes.
Okay, this season they're doing Archer Noir, so they're basically doing it with a 30s backdrop. And so they've redone the entire adventure as a noir adventure, so you get a lot of these tropes sitting up here.
That's funny.
It's a blast, man. Like, I would recommend it, you know, even if you're not a fan of the series, this season's better than most. And of course, you know why I mentioned sports figures, don't you? Flash Gordon.
Oh, Flash Gordon, that's true.
The all-American boy football player who just happens to get involved in this thing. In fact, that's a common trait if you play a competent teenager in an atomic horror thing campaign. You're usually a sports star of some sort because, you know, America.
Yeah, especially at that time, that was a very common trope.
Mm-hmm. You know, the guy that won the big game is going to save the universe as well, which makes part of the fun. And of course, your favorite, spies.
Oh yeah, I mean, you almost can't get away from them. I mean, especially when you look at, I mean, the 60s, I mean, you have all the James Bond movies.
Yeah, again, it's the key to is the prime of the Cold War, you know, where you had the Man from U.N.C.L.E. or the thing there. In fact, we can jump back to our other adventure when we talk about spy games.
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking of, like, Thunderball. That involved atomic weapons.
Absolutely.
You know.
And again, and only James Bond can save the day. Unfortunately, that also reminds me, Roger Moore just recently passed away. Which sucks, but I just thought I should bring it up.
Yeah, you know, it's weird. It's like, yeah, I remember listening to something about Roger Moore where I guess he had done The Saint.
Yeah.
And then I guess because of The Saint, when they decided they needed a new James Bond, probably one of the reasons they picked him for be the new James Bond, and when he learned that he was going to be James Bond, he had taken, I think he was out at dinner one time, and his son asked him if he learned he was going to play, "Well, Dad, do you think you could take anyone in this room?" And he looked around, and it was just a bunch of old men. He says, "Oh, probably. I don't see why not." And then his son was like, "Oh, but Dad, what if, like, James Bond showed up?" And he's like, "Well, Daddy's going to play James Bond." "No, no, no, the real James Bond, Sean Connery."
Oh, oh man, that's hilarious.
So, I don't remember. It was like on some, I was watching something and they were talking about that. I don't know if it was an interview that he was doing or something. It was just, it was hilarious. I'm just like, that's funny.
Absolutely, that sounds fun.
So,
and
you have my favorite last. The yokel. Oh,
exactly.
You know, usually the guy in the that, you know, lives in the bayou or whatever. He's like, "I'm just a dumb country bumpkin," if you will.
Yeah. And then a satellite shows up or a dinosaur shows up and it's going, "What the hell is this dude in my bayou?"
Exactly.
You know, it adds a really unique element there because nobody's going to believe him anyway.
And sometimes, and it's weird because sometimes the yokel is smarter than everybody else.
Well, that's a common theme, you know, good old-fashioned American know-how.
Yeah.
Okay, well, now we get to one of my favorites, of course, monsters, which you have a lot to choose from, all sorts of stuff here. Of course, the most common ones are aliens, you know, usually come into three basic categories. Elder brothers, you know, you got your those great aliens that are more powerful than we could ever possibly imagine. You got your evil empires. You got space savages, and of course, a lot of the times the aliens are often considered reskinned commies for the most part. You know, that way you wouldn't have to talk about the Red Scare, but you'd basically compartmentalize it to some degree. Or you could end up with the flying saucers, which were particularly common, especially after the incidences involving UFOs during this era.
Mm.
you know, like Roswell just happened a couple of years before this era officially began, and it really ended up leaving an imprint into how people saw things. You know? And then, of course, one of my favorites, blobs, which can basically be either considered irradiated or aliens. They're basically dropped on the planet, and then you have a whole bunch of people run screaming from them.
Well, yeah. That's a classic monster movie, The Blob.
Exactly. Yeah, it was kind of fun watching it there. I saw it a while back, and it was just, I enjoyed it. Mind you, it's kind of hard. It's hard to take it seriously, but at the same time, I think it would be terrifying to actually deal with one of those things. Of course, you always have disembodied brains. Like, one of my favorites, the brain that wouldn't die. You know, they couldn't exactly show the brain in the jar, but they had the lady's head under the white thing, and they basically treated her like a super psyche when they removed her head from her body. And you got to have bug-eyed monsters of some sort. That's when you get the really cool rubber costumes. And you got the gigantic monsters, which essentially are jacked up due to radiation. This is where you get the big bugs, like
the giant ants.
Yeah, from them.
Yeah.
Or beginning of the world, the grasshoppers. You know, just pick some crazy bug, you know, and make it go to town, and then have a whole bunch of people run screaming from it. Plus, they were really cheap to produce, because you could use forced perspective to actually make the damn things. Just put it really near the camera and basically just use that to show why they're so huge. And, of course, you had the giant people ones, like, was it The Amazing Colossal Man?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, or Attack of the 50-Foot Woman.
That's the classic one that everyone, I think, remembers.
Yeah, you got this thing that basically, he's radiated, suddenly becomes really big and usually becomes some sort of monster because of it, you know, basically a variation of King Kong.
I was just thinking the other way. Yep. The Incredible Shrinking Man.
You're right. I forgot about that one.
You know, because that was classic, because it's like he kept shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, and then everyday things were dangerous.
And that just makes it so darn dangerous. Like, what I would recommend, if you can hunt it down, there's this great movie that covers snippets from all these other movies. It's called It Came from Hollywood. It was done like in the early 80s. Hmm. It had Dan Aykroyd, John Candy, all sorts of things. And they were in Cheech and Chong, and it was a clip show from all these various movies, so I don't even know if you think you can get it on tape because of the different copyrights, but it's a great way to get a little snippet from all the different sci-fis and see what you like.
Yeah.
Anywho. Yeah, and of course, one of the things is, I'm going to try to not go through relatively quickly because we talked about prehistoric dinosaurs last week, but prehistoric survivors are often common because, again, this is the era of Harryhausen. And as a result, you wanted a monster, you gave it to Harryhausen.
Yeah. And, you know, it's actually interesting. I was watching something earlier, and it's like on TV, it just happened to come on one of the channels, and they were talking about how, realistically, some of the stuff that Harryhausen did really influenced the Japanese to make Godzilla.
I believe it, because I know, well, dude, he began with King Kong and only went up from there.
But he had done some early work, and there's some things that, okay, you know, monsters are big, and somewhere along the line it just kind of translated over because it was cheap. You know, that's the funny thing. Those movies, oddly, were cheaper than other things you could make. I mean, especially like Godzilla. You have a guy in a suit. How hard is it to make that movie? I mean, the miniature sets are cheap compared to, you know, doing it the other way, which was, you know, like the way he was doing with stop motion animation. That was more expensive.
It absolutely was
cheaper to build larger miniature sets and have some guy in a suit destroy them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that, and way, of course, it fed into the atomic scare because, oh, hey, this creature had radioactive breath.
Mm-hmm.
So,
in fact, they often use that as the beginning of the Age of Kaiju, which
it is.
I don't know if there's enough meat on the potatoes to do its own episode, but it's definitely something to worth thinking about because I'm a diehard fan of the Kaiju era. You know, for all their cheesy costumes and the silly plots, I ain't gonna lie to you. I just saw Kong of Skull Island. I loved it. Mind you, it felt like, I called it Apocalypse Kong because that's kind of what it feels like. It takes place at the end of the Vietnam War. So they're acting like, well, guys from Vietnam. You got these choppers flying in, dropping bombs because, you know, they're taking seismic readings. But it feels like, you know, it feels like Apocalypse Now. And then suddenly the ape shows up, not very happy, and beats the trap out of him.
So, all right. Awesome. So let's go on to the next one, which is kind of fun.
Well, again, you're literally right after World War II, so you're always going to be worried that Nazis somehow survived. You know, there's the boys from Brazil, there's moon Nazis, there's the Antarctic colony, there's hollow world concepts. Basically, if the Nazis survived, where are they? And more importantly, what can you do about them?
And what are they up to?
Exactly, because do they have some sort of super weapon that they managed to build at the last weapon? Because, you know, if you study World War II, they had all sorts of crazy experiments. None of them panned out, but what if one did?
Oh, actually, you know what's weird? I was just thinking was, you know, I was thinking super weapons, and I remember this really weird movie. It didn't take place in World War II. It took place in World War I.
Oh, wow.
And it was a time travel movie, because the main character time traveled from World War II to the present, and then back into... one of the main characters traveled, and then the other main character was in the present and traveled back into World War I, and involved a German weapon that they were using some sort of weird ground-based sound weapon or something.
Oh, that could be fun.
What the hell was that?
Starman, I don't have a clue.
I'm going to look it up. I want to say it was like Bigglesworth Adventures in Time.
That sounds like an awesome name. Well, you do that. I'll just plug away a little bit here. Of course, we talked about the Red Scare a lot. Like, if you really want, you could basically make a Cold War movie and either have them as reluctant enemies or allies or enemies or what have you on top of the monstrous horror or alien thing. Or maybe they make an irradiated commie. Suddenly they throw it at their thing, they drop it off, and suddenly it invades from the sea across to Alaska and just sort of walks its way towards the thing. That alone would scare the crap out of you. And we've mentioned both killer robots and killer plants since I've been here, so I'll just pour over those quickly. Basically, more tin cans. Ultimately, your robots would basically be the death machines that look like tin cans with, you know, wavy arms, assuming they're not unfriendly. Or they might be the creation of aliens, you know, just your typical goodness. Like, I always look at that one thing that... there's this one movie where you have this entire Finnish family who are the last people on Earth, and you have this robot that's essentially a gorilla costume with a diver's helmet.
Oh, yes, that's like one of the worst movies around.
Yeah. Biggles Adventures in Time. But thanks, Jeff. That was awesome.
Yeah, it was one of those weird movies that it's like, it sounds ridiculous, and it is kind of ridiculous, but it's a guilty pleasure watch. At least for me.
Oh, absolutely.
Because my favorite scene, you know, is the main one, the World War One character comes into the present and ends up, you know, I don't know how, but he ends up flying a helicopter, and his reply was, "If you can fly a Southwest Camel, you can fly anything."
That's awesome.
You know? And I'm like, completely different kind of flying, pal, but okay.
Yeah. Well, I guess what we can get to next is just the common places. Like, you're going to have a setting of some sort. Often it's you're in the big city and something happens there, or you end up in the underground of the Earth, which I've talked about in the past. But more often than not, a B-movie ends up in a small town, USA. It's a town in the middle of nowhere where something weird happens. And, you know, you're having your typical day, typical setup, and then suddenly it happens, whatever that may be.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you take, like, The Blob, or hell. Mm-hmm. I mean, even take, like, come on, Jeff. Think it through. War of the Worlds.
The War of the Worlds
movie. Same basic thing.
Yeah, well, they were at... Yeah, I remember that. And it was like, wow, it's been too long.
You know, that movie, it's interesting. There was actually a War of the Worlds TV series.
I remember that. That starred, like, Adrian Duncan for second season.
Yeah.
Adrian, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It was one of those weird TV series where the first season, I don't know, R2, and it's like the later seasons completely changed the concept of what the hell they were doing. And you're just like, what the hell am I watching? But it was like, the first one was like, it was like the concept was, it is that, you know, the War of the Worlds movie happened, but the aliens didn't die.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, they actually did a version of that for League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, where the second book took place during the Martian invasion around 1888. And, of course, you got this crackdown of heroes that basically had to use a virus, and it broke up the team because of that, because it was considered biological warfare. So, you know, just fun stories. What was the name of that place? Frick. Grover's Mill, that's it, New Jersey.
I think that was common in several other things.
Yeah, well, again, you take one small town, you go from there. And, again, if you're not going to go there...
Oh, yes, 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 War of the Worlds. What am I talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the... I mean, hell, I mean, even if you take... You know what? Actually, even if you extrapolate that to Buckaroo Banzai...
Adventure in the Fifth Dimension.
Yeah. Oh, such a... That's another one of those weird movies that is a guilty pleasure to watch nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And I one of the things I love about it is there are things in that movie that they don't ever try to explain. And yeah. I know that sounds weird, but it's like there's a scene where they go through somewhere and there's a watermelon, like between like two like in, like being compressed or something like that, and it's like they don't explain what the hell it's doing. Nowhere in the movie do they ever explain that. My understanding is that I think it's explained like in some comic or something somewhere, but they never explain it in the movie. They never bother. And oddly, okay. I like that kind of stuff in movies where it's like stuff happens and it's like they don't necessarily explain it. They don't talk down to you. It's like there's just stuff that would happen that you don't need to know about or you just don't know about.
It's a matter of de facto.
Yeah, it's just like it happened.
Absolutely.
So.
And of course, like we said before, underseeing the space or other crucial environments there. Like, this is when you still get the last of what I call ray gun space. Because we haven't actually been up there, so it makes sense you'd have a rocket ship and you have a jetpack and those cute helmets. And you'd basically go, there's all sorts of weird stuff. Like, you work under the assumption that space is safer than it actually is. And you go into, like, some weird alien planet and just sort of, you know, works both ways.
Right.
Now, as far as actual potential game engines, these are the ones I was able to figure out relatively quickly. Of course, GURPS Atomic Horror, which honestly is required reading if you ever want to do a project in this thing, even if you're not going to use the rules, because it's chock-filled with ideas. There's a really awesome adventure system called Monster of the Week, which basically is what an Atomic Horror game is. It's, hey, look, there's a Monster of the Week. Will we live through it? Or can we beat it? Or can we survive it? Let's find out. Savage Worlds is actually uniquely suited for this type of adventure because it's, well, two-fisted action on top of everything else.
Well, it is a pulp system, period. Whether it's pulp science fiction, whether it's pulp fantasy, whether it's pulp, you name it, it really does fit. You know, and it really is uniquely designed more along the lines of, you know, movie TV action.
Exactly. And I think it would work really nicely. And, of course, that's that Kickstarter we talked about a couple of months back, this Defiant Earth. The one with the paper giant ants. I'll let you know when I get it.
Yeah, I can't wait. Look
at that sucker. Okay, so...
Are there other possibilities? Depending on what you do, you might be able to run it. You know, honestly, depending on what you're trying to do, you could possibly run it with a version of Traveler or, like, one of the modern spy games, maybe.
Absolutely.
You need a little tweaking.
Mm-hmm.
That's always a possibility.
Yeah.
Something, honestly, although it's really dated, I would say, and complex, I would say something like the old Hero system. You might be able to do something with that. Or maybe one of the D6 system, you know, D6 system.
Actually, D6 might actually, West End game type D6 game.
Yeah, exactly.
You might be able to work, but it kind of works for the mood you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Because Star Wars ultimately has a similar feel for what you were trying to do. The difference is there'd be a lot less lightsabers.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, you know, and that actual system you can actually get. I mean, there's D6 Space, there's D6 Fantasy.
Yeah.
I want to say there's D6 Modern.
Yeah, just grok the heck out of it and pick up your science.
Yeah, I mean, and again, so it really depends. Or you might be able to use, like, D20 Modern, maybe, depending.
Yeah, and again, you get a lot of key celebrities from this era, like Harvey Korman. It's pretty much a given. You know, who basically... created a lion's share of his stuff during this era. You know, and of course you got to mention Ed Wood, Bela Lugosi.
Yeah, that was, by the way, Bela Lugosi was an answer in a crossword puzzle being the girlfriend did her recently.
Oh, wow. They kind of neat.
Yeah, well, it was just, you know, it was like actor Lugosi. Well, Bella, of course. You know? I don't think she knew that one. But
it's all good, man. Okay, but yeah, like, is there any particular favorite ones you want to bring up where you think you could turn into a gameable stuff?
Wow.
Yeah, well, no worries about it.
No, you know. I mean, it. There's just so many. I mean, I think when you just use Atomic Horror or something weird, I mean, God, what the hell was that damn movie? Christ.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of the damn movie. But there was all, it was one of those, it was some weird movie, science fiction movie. Had a submarine where there was it was militaristic, and the submarine was used, I swear, in some TV series, like one of the Sequest, the early Sequest, 50 Sequest, TV show or something along those lines.
Okay.
And, you know, obviously they were traveling, I think, to the North or South Pole to launch nuclear weapons to, like, disrupt the Van Allen belt or something bizarre like that, or restart it.
Yeah.
You know, because due to some sort of weird inversion, the planet was heating up or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that would, you know, that's actually an adventure that, you know, and I think they encounter undersea monsters or problems or whatever is going on. It's like, that'd be a great adventure for players. Or even, honestly, even King Kong. You know, yep. A King Kong scenario. You know, that's very pulpish even. It's like, oh, you encountered the planet. Or even like I said, you know, obviously, you know, something along the lines of War of the Worlds, you know, is very classic.
Mm-hmm.
Or like the Blob, or, you know, hell, even the Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yep, definitely. I mean,
you do. You get into that monster era, and you're just like, there's anything.
Precisely.
You know.
And if you have any doubts, listen to the first song of the Rocky Horror Picture Show and see how many you've actually seen. Oh. Stuff like that, like the Crawling Terror, the Killer Shrews, the Eye Terrors. I think that's none of them. I'll have to remember that one. Or if you want to mix it a bit more pulpy, I actually have a link to a cheesy TV show cartoon that was on during that era. You may have heard of it. It's called Rocket Robin Hood.
No, I don't think I have.
Oh, man. It's campy. It's a kid's cartoon from the 60s. What do you think it looks like? So, you know, again, I guess the big question is, how much atomic do you want your horror, and how pulpy? Like, you basically have a line between horror and pulp, and where you want to put it is going to ultimately determine what you want to do with it.
But there's a lot of fun to be had.
Trust me, you could have a blast just running one-shotters on these suckers. And of course, if you ever have trouble figuring out a plot, pull out a random episode of The Twilight Zone.
You know, that's actually very true. And that, you know, and again, those, I think sometimes, how do I put this? I think sometimes one-shot games have a place.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, when I say one-shot, I mean, it can span like 3 or 4 sessions. But yep. Like a one-shot adventure, you know, where, and it, especially for like solo players or a couple of players, I think it's a really great concept. Mm-hmm. I think the problem that we get is like, well, I invested, you know, the players on the reverse side are like, I invested a lot into this character. I want to continue having adventures. Well, mm-hmm. That's great, but you may not be able to tell all the adventures. It's like, you can't do Terror 10,000 feet all the time. It's like, what the hell else is going to happen to this guy?
Precisely.
You know? So,
but
again, that's one of those things. If you had buy-in for like, hey, let's do some one-shots with some really eccentric characters. And I think that, again, this is where I always say that you can have adventures that are bigger than normal sometimes in the one-shots, because there's just going to be one huge arc and you're done. You never have to worry about adventures for that almost setting again. And you can almost just concentrate on the adventure and screw the setting. There's like some Absolutely. Periphery background material, and it's just the adventure.
Exactly. Versus, it makes a great card game.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, all of this would make very, all these would make very good con games.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, all right. Anything else before we go and kick into the Kickstarters?
Let's kick into the Kickstarters, man. I think we covered this thing pretty well, but if you have your favorite B movie, let us know.
Exactly. All right, so let's go with, the hell with it. I'll just start at the top. We have Dimgard, Volume, what is this, 18? 5th Edition Adventures? A couple of story arcs, a couple of supplements. I don't know.
Okay.
It's one of those things where it's their 18th volume. Wow, that's a lot of stuff. And I guess it's for an ongoing campaign stuff that they've been doing. So I'm hesitant to, I guess you might want to look at it, but I'm hesitant to ever event, you know, it's one of these things where it's like, because the first adventure takes adventures from 5th to 8th, and it's for an ongoing campaign that takes you all the way to 18th level, I guess. I don't know. I guess it's supposed to take you through a thing, and I'm just like, this is great if you've already backed the earlier ones. And I'm guessing you might. Can you buy the other one? Let me see.
Well, he only is asking for $30. Definitely made his money. I think he's just doing it for a laugh and a prayer.
Yeah, I know, but it's one of those ones where just like, well, it'd be nice if you could. Because you can get like the last months in your Kickstarter. But it's like, you know, what about the other ones? Come on. What if you find you like this one? Do you have to? I don't know. It's just kind of.
There should be a way to do back order or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Here. And I know that makes perfect sense to me. Like, if you like it, you want it.
And then I guess that's the thing. It's like one of the supplements is the Arcane Archer. If that was your thing, they have, I guess, a 5th edition version for you.
Well, that'll be good because I don't know, man. I got some opinions on subject that probably be very unpopular when it comes to D&D around here. Like, I always found the Ranger to be a bit of a mishmash. So if you're going to do an Arcane Archer, it should almost be one of the archetypes of the Ranger concept.
Probably.
That's just a personal preference here. So I don't know without seeing it, so we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know. It can go either way. So next up, I thought this one was interesting just because I talked. Did I talk about the Army Men, the World War II Kickstarter? We're like, or not. I can't remember if I did or I didn't.
I think we had a big talk about some sort of World War II Kickstarter involving miniatures. Is it actual tabletop game?
No, this was just the miniatures, 28mm.
Oh, wait, is that the one with the tanks?
It had some Sherman tanks, yes.
Oh, that's right, and we're, okay. But you couldn't get, like, Yagers or anything like that. Yeah, no. Panthers.
But there is this one Kickstarter for Resin Terrain for World War II games, and it's in 28mm.
28, you say?
Yep. Hmm. So, you know, you can just like brick walls, pillbox, which it's cool. And they have some craters. I like the resin craters. Now, downside is this is a UK Kickstarter, so I don't. But, and it says only certain countries, and I don't know if the US is on them. I didn't bother to look at that. I'm assuming yes. But even if not, I think it's still kind of interesting for our folks across the Atlantic.
Indeed. Well, again, you can never go wrong without a good World War II setup here, that's for sure.
Yeah, I kind of like that. You know, just kind of like the concept of. The only thing I can think of I'd play with this is World War II. Weird Wars 2. Not World War II. Weird Wars 2.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Like, you know, I'd be fully in for a Weird Wars game.
That's for sure. Actually, my favorite one I've run so far had to be Tour of Darkness.
Yeah, Vietnam.
Yeah, mainly because I think with World War II, I feel a little too tied to what actually happened. Whereas in Vietnam, there was a lot of weird actions all over the place that made no sense anyway.
So I can see that.
So I can feel like I can break from that
a little more. What's really interesting is, you know, Ken Hyde, the guy that's doing World of Darkness, he did the book called Follow Delta Green. It takes place in 1969 in Vietnam, where essentially they found the King Yellow in Vietnam and all things go to hell because of it. Yeah. So, you know, just part of the fun.
All right, this one is kind of weird, and I don't think the guy is going to make it. He has 25 days. He's asking for $50,000, has 112.
Yikes. What's the name?
Blood and Bones. Tabletop PC role-playing game. And the tagline says, think D&D meets White Wolf meets Battletech, but with digital character sheets. And I think probably up to where he said Battletech, people were like, well, okay, maybe. But with digital character sheets, they're like, do I need digital character sheets? I don't know if I want to do that.
Well, the problem is with electronics is we're kind of spoiled that way.
Yeah.
When it comes to that sort of thing here. So, and it's a neat concept is when it comes to electronics, it costs an arm and a leg for not a lot of return. And I don't think we're there yet where we're willing to support video games because there's been a lot of horror situations when it comes to, you know, tabletop software usually has a better return when it finally gets funded. But there's been a few burn experiences involving, you know, paying for a video game that doesn't come out in 3 years from now.
Yeah.
And then basically something goes wrong because, you know, at least with a tabletop game, I think we mentioned in the past, you write it, it's done. You might not get exactly what you want, but you at least get something.
Yeah. He has an interesting comment. He says, risks and challenges. The biggest challenge I foresee is making a lot of money from this game. Well, yeah. No shit. The tabletop gaming market is crowded and is on a gradual decline. I'm not sure if I agree with the gradual decline. I mean, I think we've had ebbs and flows in this hobby, period.
I think it's just part of the nature of the beast. It goes up, it goes down, yeah. And I would argue it's probably more robust than it was a couple of years ago. Like, I would honestly, about 5 years ago, felt like this hobby was dying. Now, with the help of Kickstarters and personality and geek cred on the internet, I'd argue that it's actually coming up again a little bit. Well, plus the introduction of 5th edition, for all its faults, it is the main spear point of the gaming industry.
Well, here's what I say, is I've been gaming a long time. And I think especially Kickstarters is definitely, I think, we may see a decline in the big publishers, period.
Yeah.
I think in that aspect, yes, there's going to be probably a lot of small publishers. There may still always be a big publisher or two. But again, like there's a reason we mentioned the Kickstarters, because I really think that's where all the interesting material is. And someone once said, I really don't want, you know, the RPG gaming hobby to become like the model train industry, you know, hobby.
Mm-hmm.
And everything's caught as industry there. And I'm like, yeah. I got news for you. The RPG gaming hobby has almost always been there. It's just had a facade of being larger than it is.
Now, the only reason you had the big sales of the 80s, you know, the early 80s, is because it was shiny, new, and a serious fad during that period because there was only one game in town, really. You know, D&D, and then everybody else was just, everybody played every, that was the game that everybody went to. And as
And D&D became a known value for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is what I call the Great Witch Hunt.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it seemed like so spooky that everybody wanted to try it.
Exactly.
But again, there's also splintering between editions, between hobbies, and as a result, I don't think it's ever going to have the big, great name. Like, the only one that I can even think that might have any sort of degree of returns when it comes to their gaming product is Monty Cook, but he does it very specifically. Where even people like Robert Laws or Kenneth Hyde or Fred Hicks, they got to fight tooth and nail for every penny. Yeah. Or even Steve Jackson, man. Like, the guy's trying to retire, but he doesn't have enough money to, you know, he did Ogre, and he almost lost as much money as he made on the thing.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you overpromise.
Yeah. Well, again, it's just a cautionary tale because there's a shiny new... Well, that was back in the beginning of the age of Kickstarter, so as long as people want to build products and get them out to at least somebody, because this is the way you make money in the gaming industry, is you make a decent Kickstarter and you hope for the best.
Yeah. Well, And so, speaking of the gaming industry, though, we do have a convention on a Kickstarter, which, again, I think this is the way that conventions are going to be funded from almost now on, more and more. And we have the Big Bad Con of 2017, October 13th through 15th, and it is in the Bay Area, California Bay Area.
That sounds neat.
And they actually, I like this. We've also created Big Bad World, a powered by the apocalypse metagame running all convention long.
I like that. That's a good way to gamify the even adventure and make a little meta.
Yeah, I like that. So, if you're in, if you happen to be in the area, want to go? It is
October 13th to 15th.
Yeah.
And they made their goal, so basically, it's just, do you want in?
Yeah, exactly. they were only asking $3,000. They got $16,000,
mm-hmm.
and plus.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess 50. The badge is kind of expensive. The con badge is $50, but that's not unusual.
No, and again, you got to pay for it if you want it.
Yeah,
you know, just some places you can cut a corner or two, but ultimately, running a convention is. Well, after talking to our buddy there, he gave us a bit of an insight on how extensive you have to be for such a thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, and so now we go to, you know, we all love battle mats, so I'm going to bring this one up. We have battle mats and counter mats. And it's interesting because there's a variable that's printed and there's digital image versions. And it's just, you know, a battle mat, but it has a nice, like, cracked tile look to it. At least some of the tiles are cracked. Kind of has like a worn tile look.
Yeah, I kind of like that. It kind of has a neat look to it, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I like how they have a tiny dinosaur enclosure. Again, that kind of shoots back to last time. Or lava caverns and so forth. They got a whole list of stuff.
I do like that the mat, the one for 10 pounds, which is about $13 US, is... The printed vinyl mat is 24 by 24.
Ooh.
Which is 2 feet by 2 feet. That actually is not bad, because some mats I've had are way too big for the tables I'm dealing with.
Yeah, that
so
is true.
So it's kind of nice to have like a smaller mat, or you know, just have a smaller mat that you can take with you sometimes.
Well, one of the things they show on the table and the sticker underneath is they have a bunch of little maps, and you basically just connect them together.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's options. I like it.
Yeah.
And they have different... possible maps, and I guess you also can get some of the digital maps too. They have them as printed and digital.
Yep.
Yeah, 20 encounter maps, digital maps. So that's kind of cool. I like that.
Yeah, and if you want to support them, they're about $30 up to their $100 goals. So basically, if you like what they see, sponsor them and get them over the touch line.
Yeah. So here's one that I'm not sure. This is one of those ones where I'm not sure I could ever play evil characters.
Okay.
But so, it is the Book of Exalted Darkness, Evil Adventures for 5th Edition. And I kind of get where they're going with this, but it's not for me. But par be it for me to tell someone that, hey, you know, because I've known a lot of people, that, oh, I've run an evil campaign. Well, what's really... You know, and then, of course, this gets into the concept of, you know, what is evil and what's not evil in an RPG anyway.
Well, so. It's done by our buddy, the guy that did Mists of Akuma, so, you know, it's worth taking a look there, that's for sure.
No, I mean, it just, I can tell that, hey, you know, it's an interesting concept, I just know that for myself, not my thing.
Yeah, well, I won't lie to you, the reason I'm anywhere remotely interested is I saw the tagline. Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow, because that is still a fun gaming environment concept.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's almost... I mean, he has 18 days to go. He's asking for about $5,000 US, and he's about 3,400, so...
You might make it here, and if he does, well, I bought his other products and be very happy with them, so... Yeah. We know he can deliver, so it's just a matter of whether it's your cup of tea or not, ultimately.
The next one up is kind of a weird one for me, because I've never heard the material that it's based off of, which is Red Moon Rising RPG, role-playing in the steampunk world of Red Moon Rising using Revolution D100. I've never heard of Red Moon Rising, which is some sort of webcomic. Have you?
No, unfortunately, I have not. So, it looks fun. I like the art. Rose Logren seems to be the guy who did it.
I mean, they got 22 days to go. They have about 3/8 of the money they need. Because they're asking about, I guess the conversion puts it at about $8,300 US.
Yep. And it sounds pretty cool. Like, it's got different magic technology. It's got airships.
Yeah, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, it's interesting. It's hard for me to, since I've never read the comic, it's hard for me to really understand what's going on with it.
Well, when in doubt, let's use TV tropes to fill in the blanks. See what it says. There we go. It's a fantasy steampunk webcomic started in 2009, so Okay, so it's basically a fantasy steampunk environment, which now gives you an idea what sort of environment it's like. It could be fun. Don't know about the mechanics, but if this is your cup of tea, it might be a blast.
Yeah. All right, what else? Oh, more battle mats. Jeez, there were a lot of battle mats.
Okay.
Although, I have to say, I don't like these as well. Which is probably why they only have $30 out of $100 pledged.
Oh, well. C'est la vie.
Yeah, there's other battle mats I think looked a little better. I mean, I hate to say it, this looks like some digital art that someone just had and just put down.
Yeah, it looks like a brick, but, you know, don't get me wrong, it might be fun to have, like, you need a backdrop, like the Urban Decay one looks pretty good.
Yeah.
And Wastelands, but, you know, I don't know. I'd have to think on this one.
Yeah, it looks like, I don't know. I almost want to say the way this looks like. It looks like it was just designed to get these printed out and you could like throw down on the table.
I don't mind that as far as that's concerned. It's like good concept as any.
Yeah.
It looks like something that could be done. Well, we'll see. You know, I'm not going to say nothing because honestly, I don't know how much work or effort went into this sucker. He's made his money, so you can't complain there. Like, he only needed 500 pounds, and he got 2,522, so basically you're just paying if you like it. So, I don't know, food for thought. And if you like it, go for it. Otherwise, don't.
I think we're looking at different maps.
Okay.
You're looking at the Meanders, too, which is the one I was going to talk about. This is the digital sci-fi maps. These look actually pretty interesting.
Frick. Okay. Sorry, wrong map. Okay, yeah. I stand completely and utterly corrected.
Yeah. There was the other ones that were, they were like, they only got pledged $30. I think they were looking like $100 or something ridiculous.
No, is that the mortar resin drain?
I don't know. Let's not even waste time talking about it anymore.
Okay, we're done.
But the Meanders 2 map, these digital sci-fi maps and terrains, these look interesting.
Yeah.
So these would be possibly interesting to get. I probably won't. Mainly because, you know, I have to pick and choose when I do these things. But I do like them.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, they're all, you know, especially like, you know, these are all virtual tabletop ready, which is important to me because, you know, I do a lot of virtual tabletop games, or I used to. Oh. And, I mean, the sample set, if you just want any 10 maps from the set, I mean, that's $4 U.S., That is dirt cheap. And
yeah.
Then $15 for all 48 digital maps, plus any possible stretch goals. Yeah, that's a good sell.
Yeah, this is the one with the market district, the entertainment district, customs and detention.
Oh, okay, the returning backers are $20. But yeah, okay, let's just go down to the $20. I mean, $20 for all 48 digital maps plus the stretch goals. That's still not bad.
Yeah, well, it has a real sci-fi element here. It'd be a little less to use for if you, like, want to do a space game, that's for sure.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. It's like, you know, I could always use an entertainment district or a market district, or I like the customs and detentions area.
Yes.
Or the space hotel, or a food. I mean, some of this stuff, oh, yeah. You know, because it's like, I don't know why, but I was just thinking it'd be fun to run a Dredge Dead campaign all of a sudden for a short period of time.
Amen. Yeah, when in doubt, you go into a freaking apartment complex and you got to work your way up.
Exactly. All right. Next up, we have NPCs for Hire, Fantasy Races. So basically, Illustrated RPG, there's two editions, they say, is back with two editions. And, it's just some interesting. I kind of like a little bit of the, I don't know, what is this, pencil drawing artwork, I guess, effectively?
Yeah.
I think that's kind of cool.
Oh, absolutely, and it's good drawing. Give him full kudos for that.
Yeah.
So and it looks like,
what was that?
Oh, they've got different editions, like the Elf and Demon edition, the Dwarf and Halfling edition.
Yeah, so depending on what you want to do, it's like, it's $20 for the different two editions. And then
yeah.
It's $35, I guess, for the Elf and Demon and the Dwarf and Halfling edition.
Yeah. And if you want to have a custom burger done by these guys, throw $100 at them.
Yeah. And then they actually have, I guess the ultimate bundle is, they include, I guess they did a human edition earlier. So they did the human edition, the elf and demon edition, the dwarf and halfling edition. And then they throw in the NPC for Hire app for free, which I'm not sure what that app does.
No, I'm not seeing it right off the top of my head.
Okay, here we go. Has all the portraits from the human edition. We updated with all the portraits of the Kickstarter. So that's kind of interesting, I guess.
That'd be a good way to click and go, but okay.
I mean, they got about 10, they're asking for 10 grand. They're at 62 and some change. So possibly.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like that. All right.
Indeed.
So next up is a Savage Worlds one. I actually, when I saw this, we forgot to mention it. I mean, it came out like the day I think I posted the episode. They've actually reached their funding. Buccaneer, through hell and high water for Savage Worlds. It's a pirate witch hunters, pirate voodooists and witch hunters battle each other and beasts of legend in the mystic waters of the Caribbean. What more could you want?
If you ever wanted to play Pirates of the Caribbean, this is your game.
This is your game. They were asking for 7 grand. They're actually almost closer to 10 now. And just to get the PDF copy of the rules is $15. That's not bad. And then the soft cover with the PDF is $25.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't bad.
Yeah, it could be a lot of fun just trying to play out the Caribbean and hope for the best. Like, it'd be interesting to see what they play up and what they don't play up.
Yeah, I like, again, like I said, I like the concept. I mean, actually, you know, what's interesting is, like, something like this might make an interesting addition to, like, a Solomon Kane game.
Well, it's in the same world for the most part, just for Yonder.
Well, you don't know. But I'm just saying, you know, you could use it as some, you know, maybe a supplement or something for that, or maybe you use Solomon Kane as a supplement for this.
Exactly. It's all the same system, therefore you can mix it together.
Yeah, pretty much. There are rule differences. I hate to say it. It's the same system. It's not quite the same.
Yep.
Same basic engine, but not necessarily the same game.
That's true.
All right. Let's get to the last two and get the hell out of here. How about that sound?
Sounds good.
All right, so we have Maximum Mayhem Dungeons, Monsters of Mayhem number 1. It's a monster supplement for basically any edition of D&D, Labyrinth Lords, Savage Worlds, not Savage Worlds, Swords and Wizardry. And they were asking only for $500. They got $42.95 right now. They have about 5 days left to go as we record this. We do have this in software and print options due to high demand. Okay. I don't know. I guess people looked at the cover and said, hey, this looks good.
Hey, you can never have too many monsters.
And if you just wanted the PDF, $10. That's not
bad. They have their own version of the Rock Labs, the Pandora's Worms.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's kind of neat. And they basically explain what monsters are going to be in there, at least give a highlight of those suckers.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's well done. We'll see where it goes.
And I do have to say, I do like the... I'm a big fan of pen and ink.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, it gives it that old school feel, which actually really does feel nice.
You know, I hate to tell people, but it's like there's something. The reason I like pen and ink drawing per se over some of the more, you know, people say, "Oh, I gotta have color." No, I don't. I like the pen and ink because I like the detail that you can actually put in pen and ink that you can't really doesn't sometimes translate well when you add color.
Yeah, and on top of that, it keeps your cost down. Like, I love a beautiful cover, but at the same time, I prefer to have most of the art inside being black and white because, well, you're spending less and you're spending less on material for the poor guy who's actually having to produce the damn thing.
I can't pronounce this guy's name, but I love his photo for the author.
Oh, here, let's take a look.
It's down towards the end.
He looks like the guy from Falling Down.
I love him rocking the pocket protector. I'm sorry. I would never wear one, but I love it.
It's got an attitude. That's awesome.
Yeah. I like it. He's like, I'm a software engineer, actor, filmmaker, and game designer. Hey. That's rocking some serious things there.
Absolutely, man. He's obviously got talent, and more importantly, he knows how to raise money.
Exactly. All right, and now last up, we have. I thought I covered this one because I couldn't remember if I did or didn't. But then I read the description again. I'm like, no. But we had a cyberpunk one last week. The last time that was that weird hip hop fusion one, right?
Yeah, I remember that.
And I swear I mentioned this one, but I can't remember that I did. And we did a search and we couldn't find it. So The Veil Cascade, a post cyberpunk role playing game, and. It's powered by the apocalypse. That's why I'm thinking it sounds familiar, but I'm guessing not.
That's probably why, because let's just take a look here. No, this is a totally different one than the one we talked about last week.
Okay. But, again, it's the apocalypse system, so it kind of, has that going for it. Dungeon World, Apocalypse World, Tremulous, variations thereof.
Mm-hmm. And basically, his main reason he's raising is he's got the game done. He's just waiting for artwork and layout is the big things he's basically raising money for.
And he has his, he's reached his goal. He was only asking, the conversion ended up being, a little over $4,000. He has like 11, almost
yeah.
11 and a half, over $11,500 US.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you just want the PDF copy, that's like $7 US.
This has almost more of a Ghost of the Shell feel than the other one.
Yeah.
So, definitely. I like it.
Yeah, I definitely agree with it. It has that look. So, I can appreciate.
Indeed.
Yeah, I it's funny. I own Interface Zero, the second edition, but I would probably play this over Interface Zero.
Interesting. It's got like a design team behind it. Like, you see five or six different people who work their asses off in this sucker.
Yeah.
Including somebody who has a PhD candidate at York University, so they obviously did their homework. Holy crud, this is overeducated people writing role-playing material.
Hey, why not? If you got nothing, it's an exercise in, I don't know what you want to call it.
Creativity.
Yep, we'll go with that.
That works.
And that's it.
Yep.
Wow, made it through the episode. Oh, bundle of holding.
Absolutely. Let's grab those.
And then we can close out this episode and let people have some time back, as we used to say.
Exactly. Well, we have a tendency to meander, but that's part of the charm. We didn't make you switch the button.
The button?
Okay.
What button is that?
The play button.
Oh, you mean like this button here?
Exactly. Okay, so according to what I'm seeing here, there's two... If I'm reading this right.
I couldn't help that one.
Oh, no problem, man. Hey, I'm an MST3 camp fan. It's almost expected here at this point. Push the button, Frank. Okay, the Shadow of the Demon Lord is one of the two bundle of holdings, which is pretty awesome. Like, I've heard nothing but good things about it. I've yet to play it myself, but I won't lie to you. It's basically essentially a grim heroic study against the void that hungers. So essentially, it's dark fantasy. So if that's your cup of tea, this would definitely be worth it because it's got a lot of material for what its price is. And the other one is called Fading Suns Plus 2. So, I think we talked about Fading Suns last time here. So, basically, it's a space environment in the near end of the universe where, I guess the best way to describe it is, it's space fantasy near the end of the era. So, like, last time I played it, I played a fencer, a duelist. So, that's got a lot of the court aspects and intrigues on top of the regular tech. As well as arcane tech and so forth.
Okay.
So, if that's your cup of tea, well, you can buy it in bulk today.
All right, then.
And I think that's pretty much all she wrote.
All right, then. I will say adieu, and we will... if you have some comments, send us email and info at rbgcircus.com. You can post something on our Facebook page, Google Plus page. Just look for RPG Circus. We're there. If you want to go to our homepage... at rbcircus.com. There's a link to send us a voicemail app. Voicemail? I even hate to call it a voicemail. I'm just going to say audio comment from now
that
on.
Works.
You can send us an audio comment that way. We haven't had any, really. I'd love to have some, so send me something. I don't care what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You can be as vulgar as you like, I guess. You're not going to... You can't offend me. Actually, I don't know. I hate to say that, because then I'm sure someone will say, I accept your challenge, sir.
Well, if you offend us, guess what? We reserve the right to mock you.
Yeah, exactly. So that's it. You know, send us some stuff. We'll be more than happy to shout it out to you. And I guess we'll see everyone in about 2 weeks then. That sound good to you?
Sounds good to me.
All right, then. We will see everyone in 2 weeks.
Cheers.
RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.